It's a space for conversation, that's the idea, which is why there's tea and coffee, is why there's a fire pit, and this space is a bit more of a focused conversation space. So throughout the weekend, we have various different guests coming in to lead a conversation and to encourage you to join in a conversation with each other. So we want to make you very welcome, and we hope that you find this an interesting and possibly challenging space. And we hope you enjoy the conversations that might happen here. So without further ado, I'll pass you over to our conversation beginner for this evening, who is Professor Danny Dorling, who I'm sure you're all aware of, because I guess you've probably heard him speak somewhere else.
Thank you ever so much for that. Thanks for coming. I'm going to talk at you for only 10 minutes, and then I'm going to get you to talk to each other, and then we'll see how it goes from then onwards. I'm a proper university professor, which means I didn't understand the title of this. Brexit Food a Gift Shop is apparently an allusion to a popular song. Yes. Anybody else know that? Exit Food a Gift Shop, yeah. That gives you an idea about my inabilities. And the blurb, I didn't write the blurb. Fickle treat. For Remainers, it will be the most frightening Halloween ever. For Brexiteers, it will be the best night of their lives. There's no doubting that Brexit has divided our country as never before. Join me in a small group conversation as we face the autumn, as the UK heads towards the next deadline, and explore how we can be bridge builders in our riven and unequal communities. So that's my remit to try to get you talking about. I thought I'd start with the Ladybird book of Brexit. One of the most wonderful things. I'll just read you the first page of this. Britain is a proud island. For centuries we stood alone. Now we stand alone again. Other countries like Croatia and Spain need to be part of Europe because they are clearly cowards. But our country is special, and other countries are queuing up to get what we have to offer. Whether it is the music of Sting or any of our several mild cheeses. This is the future. Okay, and then a little bit. I wrote a book with Sally Tomlinson. It was published on the 15th of January this year. The 15th of January was the date you could have predicted 6 months before would be the date of the meaningful vote, which wasn't very meaningful. You've probably forgotten the first meaningful vote. We've had several meaningful votes which haven't been meaningful at all. This is from the start of Chapter 8, called The Land of Hope and Glory. Brexit has been a disaster with silver linings. The process of trying to leave the EU and the end result could finally jolt the British elite out of their superior complacency and thereby make the country a fairer and more humane place. We easily forget that on the 14th of November 2011, David Cameron told guests at the annual Lord Mayor's Banquet in London that he had an opportunity to begin to refashion the EU so that it better serves this nation's interests. Such arrogance and ignorance. Things fall apart when empires crumble. Most severely at the heart of the former empire in an imperial city, and then again across the home county. Rediscovery is attempted again and again until eventually the former heart of the empire becomes reconciled to its new fate. It has always been this way, and yet we rarely try to learn from the fate of past empires. What Sally and I were trying to argue is that what we're going through, in hindsight, and nobody saw it before, it's a process of adjusting to what we actually are. We didn't know what we actually were. We had an image of ourselves which was, in general, for almost all of us, more superior than it's turning out we probably are going to be. I'm trying to get you a bit riled about this. The kind of summary of it is two world wars and one World Cup. Last time I said that, somebody complained. It's actually two World Cups because we won a cricketing one, apparently. It's a bit of a shock what's going on. We almost all complain about the fact it appears to be bungled. but that assumes that it could have been done in a way which isn't bungled. Whereas in hindsight, at least now, you could look back and actually say any attempt to leave, given what we know now, was not as easy as some people thought it would be. Who would know? I mean, some people did know that a small border on the island of Ireland was not a border, and you can't do a technological solution across it. Things like that were tricky. We've demonstrated that if you have any border, leaving is incredibly hard. Greece has a border with Bulgaria. The movements over that are now becoming much more obvious to people in both Greece and Bulgaria. It's not just, of course, our border with Ireland that matters. Our ministers didn't know, and probably most of us didn't know, just how much of our trade went through Dover. And we didn't realise just how interconnected we are. It's not just goods and widgets, it's people. We had, and still have, because of course we could cancel at any moment up to 5 minutes to midnight on Halloween, we had quite an unfair deal. It was negotiated, perhaps quite cleverly, so that we don't pay in the amount we should be paying in. That was our opt-out. But much more importantly than that, as we may be beginning to realise, we had a really unfair demographic deal with the rest of Europe. And like any other country in the EU, we were exporting more of our elderly than we were taking in. We export large numbers of elderly to Spain and to Malaga and to Malta and so on, to Greece, to Cyprus. We actually export more younger people. There are more young British people working in the mainland of Europe who are now very worried about their jobs and futures. But the exporting of the elderly people was particularly advantageous to us, because their health care was picked up by other people's health systems. David Cameron's father, Nick Clegg's father, they both died in France. The NHS didn't have to look after them. But the main demographic deal we had wasn't the exports, it was the imports. We took very large numbers of people, particularly because we chose to open our borders up early. We chose to do that. 2003-04, us along with two small countries decided to take people from the A8 accession countries early. And as a result, not just of that, but also of how many people from France come to London, how many people from Germany come, we get huge numbers, millions, of young, fit, hard-working, healthy people, because you don't migrate if you're not, that we hadn't paid for their birth, we hadn't paid for their primary education, we hadn't paid for their secondary education, we hadn't paid for their first university degree, or their second, or in some cases their third, when they now walk along a train checking your tickets. You'd be amazed how incredibly well qualified so many young people from Europe were who came. And they'll come because it's exciting, because many countries are a little bit more boring than this one. Because what is their second most useful language that they have, the one they can use the most, is English. And they come, and they come and work in our hospitals as midwives. A third of the midwives in central London are EU but not UK, despite the fact that the rent is actually more than their income, so they can't stay for that long, because it's great to put it down on your CV that you've worked in London. This was actually quite a good deal. Some of us don't think it was a good deal, but we're discovering it was a good deal. I'll end with one last example of this. And it began before Brexit. It began with a hostile environment. Many of you would have seen a kind of panorama programmes where they show people working in a care home with a hidden camera and somebody's behaving really, really badly. Normally a man. And the question people don't ask themselves is, why was that man employed in that care home? Now, around about 2010, 2011, people working in old age care homes around London and the South East began to get worried, particularly the Filipinos at first, Filipino women, because they weren't all exactly here legally. That wasn't a problem until the hostile environment began. and their landlords were told you had to check their papers. Their employers were told that we'll fine you if we find you employing anybody illegally. We actually had a very large number of people, not from the EU, but from outside, working for very low wages, doing the kind of things we don't want to do, principally looking after our elderly parents. When the hostile environment began, many of those people left. It wasn't worth staying. As the pound began to fall, more left. As the Brexit referendum campaign went through 2015, the first half of 2016, large numbers of people from the mainland of Europe did not come. It wasn't that they left, they didn't come, because it wasn't a very welcoming environment. After the result of the referendum, people began to leave. And what happens when people leave? You have to fill the jobs. And you fill them with anybody you can get, which is why you end up with that man in his 40s working in a care home abusing people. Because the person who used to do that work, that we were very lucky but unfairly got, is no longer here. We've already seen, I think, at least half the effects of Brexit on what's happened to our economy, what's happened to our labour force. It's a slow decline of standards. The city that I live in, the majority of people who work in cafes, provide food, look after the hotels, are not from the UK. Because you wouldn't possibly do those jobs if you were from the UK, because you can't afford to live in this city. The average house price is 17 times the average income in Oxford. It's actually higher than in London. London can't operate without people willing to come and work, in effect, for less than it costs to live there, out of curiosity, out of interest. We've done something which is likely to be quite damaging. We are unlikely to admit that, some of us, quite some time. But the rate at which we've been doing it, I think, will jolt us out of some of our complacency about the position we're in. Now, what I'm going to do, because that was slightly over 10 minutes, sorry, I'm going to ask you, those of you who are sitting on tables, to have a chat. And what I want you to do, the task I want you to do, is to discuss with each other and think of the hardest, most interesting question you can ask. And we'll do it for one from each of these four tables. You lot at the back, and you lot at the back. So that's six questions. You've got 5 minutes to think of a question.
You.
To ask to me, and then we'll make it more collaborative later. I won't be completely egotistical. But let's just try this, because, you know, normally you do these things, people put their hands up, you pick them. So I've never tried this before. But the idea is, if you've got about six or eight people at a table, and you discuss what question would you want to ask, nice, short question, that you think other people would like to know my attempt at the answer of. I'm not a soothsayer, I don't know everything. But let's see how that works. So I'm going to give you 5 minutes to chat to your neighbours, and then I'll stop it. At each of the four tables, group over there and a group behind there. Okay. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure,
I'll go
first.
What's your name?
Jane.
Okay, this is Jane.
Okay. So whether we leave or whether we don't leave, it's going to piss a lot of people off. How are we going to get over that?
Okay, very quick answer. The standard way of this is to think, when was the last time we did something like this? And unfortunately, it's a very, 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 very long time ago. The nearest thing is Suez, the Suez crisis. That was nationally embarrassing, but it was fairly obvious after the Americans told us we couldn't behave like that anymore, that we couldn't. I suspect that the agony will not go on for as long as we think, because new things will come in. You know, the fact that London begins to flood as the sea level rises might take our attention off. Yeah, that kind of thing. We're currently building a flood relief channel around Oxford to send the water even faster. And then Reading's going to build one. So we are going to have to heal. We do need to understand each other. I've done over 120 talks on Brexit in the last year and a half. And one effect it had on me was increasing sympathy for people who voted leave, I mean, obviously Remainer, as you can guess, but particularly old people who voted Leave, because they were often doing it almost always for their grandchildren, because they wanted their grandchildren to have a better future, and they couldn't see how else. I think we will heal, because events will move on. Who wants to ask the next one?
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. It was about the Irish backstop. I was brought up in Northern Ireland. I remember the military checking me, the car, now you drive straight over, no problems. And also linked with our relationship with Ireland. But what is the way through this whole discussion about the Irish backstop?
The Irish backstop. Most of us, I'm English. How many of you are not English? Put up your hand if you're not. Really small minority in the room. That's about 5% of people admitting not to be English, which is interesting. I just said English in the delivery. We really didn't pay much attention to the Good Friday Agreement when it happened. It was kind of nice. You didn't have to worry about bombs going off again in London. But that agreement really was an agreement of no border forever. That's why the Irish government agreed to it. The EU27 are going to hold absolutely rigid to that. That's determined. We are very, very unlikely to in effect build a wall. So I suspect we're not going to leave on Halloween, that's just my guess. I've said before I didn't think we were going to leave on the 29th of March. At some point I'm going to be wrong. But apart from anything else, you know, there's nothing special about me where I should know. And also this is highly unpredictable. If I had stood up 10 years ago, 2009, and told you the series of events that would have occurred in this country, you would have thought, what on earth is he doing? You know, it was unpredictable. We should expect the next 10 years to be unpredictable. But there is no Irish border. I have a lovely map of immigration rates across the whole of Europe. And we have one of the lowest rates of immigration into most of the UK. The north of England, most of England, the southwest is like Eastern Europe in terms of how few people there are from other places. London has a high proportion of immigrants, but most of England is really low compared to the mainland of Europe, which is really, really high, because if you're born one side of a border in Germany and you meet somebody in France and you decide you want to live together, one of you is an immigrant. Now, apart from London, the second highest rate of immigration in this country is Northern Ireland, because so many people in Northern Ireland are married to somebody from the Republic. That is why you can put no border. Just to add to this, we've never accepted that Ireland left. It was a bit of an embarrassment when they went. So we never enacted laws that said that you're different if you're in the Republic. So people who are Irish have incredible rights in this country, only because we never said they didn't. That makes it, you can vote in elections, you know, long before there was any free movement in Europe. So it's an old sore. There is absolutely no way, I'm sure Boris Johnson and his friends know this, but they're also speaking to a particular group who, you know, if you say technological solution, it's not a group who are very up on technology. Think of it mean. You should see the number of water pipes that go across that wiggly border. It's an amazingly wiggly border, by the way. It's deliveries of milk, it's nurses going across now. Number of crossing points are enormous. It is just the most ridiculous place to try and reinstate a border. It was the most ridiculous border when it was created, in hindsight. Okay, next one. Who wants to go next? Yes, you have to come up. And then we'll do something more interactive than this, I promise.
Yeah, it's sort of along the same lines. Do you think this will actually lead to the breakup of the union?
Okay. Will it lead to the breakup of the union? Yes. At least in that Scotland, I think, will go. Scotland's been heading towards going for some time. And Scotland has a whole lot of things which are already separate. A separate legal system, a separate set of banknotes, a separate education system. a separate set of newspapers. Only 8,000 people in Scotland read The Guardian, and it's even less for The Times and Telegraph, so a different media. I think Scotland's on the way out, because it's not in Scotland's interests to be governed from Westminster. It doesn't make sense, and we were in hindsight particularly cruel to Scotland. Unemployment hit the Clyde in 1977, before it hit the rest of north of England, and unemployment spread down like a cloud. We experimented with things like the poll tax and so on in Scotland. The anger in Scotland at the two-child policy for benefits is visceral. The Scottish Government, in a matter of weeks, I think, is about to introduce £10 per child benefit for every child in Scotland. It's going to cost them £180 million a year. They're already designing their own separate social security system. So certainly Scotland first. The one I'm always interested in is Wales. Wales, you're often told that Wales actually voted leave. But if you take the English out of Wales, and you've got to think where, I mean, my mum and dad migrated and retired to Wales, so I'm being fair, but they're different. But the bulk of people who were English who moved to Wales came from the West Midlands, the East Midlands, from Birmingham. Often, more than likely, wanted to get away from what they saw was going on in the Midlands. UKIP has its kind of headquarters in the west of Wales. The Western Daily Press, the special Daily Mail for Wales, which the English buy, is tricky. So I think Wales is more likely to leave than we think. It's only the English in it. And by the way, you know, if you want to worry about the effect of immigrants, the largest immigrant group in Britain is the English in Wales, including my parents, who came in, bought the houses that locals couldn't buy because they had the money they made selling them in London, Oxford or Birmingham, didn't bother to speak or learn the language, complained when they found there was another language. In two counties in Wales, children are taught in that language, and treat people who are local slightly, not everybody, but with some kind of disdain. You know, that really is a kind of immigration that is not very nice to have to deal with. And what do the English who retired to Wales do? Well, they've retired. They just absorb services as a right. You know, when we start talking about immigrants, I think we really should look at who are the immigrant groups who've had most effect on people. I can go on about this because I live in a city where I was born, where almost nobody born in a city can now afford to live in it. But nobody, people talk about the problem about immigrants in areas which are very lucky to get them and need them. Nobody talks about the effects of immigrants in a place like Oxford. And of course, most of the immigrants to my city are English. And nobody was thinking of them as immigrants, but they mean it's impossible for people who are local to stay. And I think it's quite remarkable that we don't have anger about that. We have anger from people in places which are only kept going because people have arrived. Next question. Is this table?
So yeah, we were just talking about kind of, so we all turned around and were like, whoa, that was a bit depressing, wasn't it? So I think our question is, you mentioned that we could cancel this at any time, but also there's the real possibility that it will end up happening. So what's the best way that you think is that we can start to kind of rebuild, you know, recover from all the stuff that's going on? Like, is the best way out through, or is there another way to do this?
I had thought that one possibility was that Theresa May, in the last couple of days before the 29th of March, might have stepped into Parliament, and I actually wrote her the speech. I never sent it to her. It's slightly arrogant, but Theresa May, when we have a duty of care, so she, Theresa May was a student in my department. And not just Theresa, Catherine Blakelock, who established the Brexit Party last year, was also a student in the geography department at Oxford. So we are ridiculously responsible where I work. The speech I've written for Theresa is, I have tried everything. I am a patriot. I believe in my country. There's no greater honour than serving your country. And in the interest of my country, I sent a letter this morning which has now been received, and I have revoked Article 50. I thought that was a possibility. But she didn't manage to last through to do that. It's very hard to know whether our MPs will organise themselves enough in September. They have a great incentive, apart from the fact that they do care. People don't become MPs entirely for selfish reasons. It's not an easy thing to do. You often have to be a councillor first. It's a long slog. It's a terrible hours. It's useless for your family. Don't do it unless you want to. Now, if you put yourself in the shoes of our MPs, the majority of who don't want to leave, they're faced with all this effort that they've put in being recorded as they were part of the generation that failed to stop this. So I suspect that they will actually take control of Parliament. I also suspect they'll leave Boris in charge, just with no power, over the period. But I think legally it has to be the Prime Minister who revokes Article 50 if we are to do it. So I suspect we will stumble on and on. The really interesting thing politically is Conservatives are absolutely against ever voting no confidence in their Prime Minister. Not a single Conservative voted no confidence in May. So I think the idea that a large number of them will vote no confidence in Boris, there's no historical precedent for that. So it's unlikely. An election will be really, really interesting. Just don't think you can predict it. And I'll tell you why not. The one thing we do now know, we've had opinion polls since the 1950s. The biggest swing ever in opinion polls happened in the 8 weeks before June 2017. Nothing as fast as that has ever occurred before, which is why Theresa was forced to form a minority government. And it suddenly blew all the election models out of the water. She was completely correct to call the election at the time she did. No Prime Minister had ever not got a majority who had gone to the public that far ahead in the polls. But what the electorate showed us in June 2017, and particularly the young who began voting again for the first time since the late 1980s, is that we can't predict the elections. And then, even more amazingly, the Brexit Party. And the rise of the Brexit Party, that incredible shift in public opinion, means it's even more unreliable. So the one thing we know that's certain, to be silly, is to think you know from where the polls are now what will happen in the event of an election actually being called. It really can go all over the place, and it'll depend on the events at the actual time. I have fantasy scenarios in my head, but I'm not gonna labour them on you, because it is silly how it may happen. And remember, all these people are human. We assume that they will just manage to carry on. We assume that none of them will become ill. We assume that nobody will have a stroke in respect of their age. We assume that anybody's particular personal affairs might not actually mean that they are forced to resign. We assume that there is no secret dossier out there of something really embarrassing that's gone on amongst somebody. But think, these things come out. Next question, as we compete with the music. This table over here, you're going to have to come round, I'm afraid. It's a lever in charge of the audio.
Well, I was going to ask you, can you tell us more about the benefits of leaving?
Okay, the benefits of leaving. Let's try to work these out. Right. It's tricky. It's tricky. We could, okay, let me try and do the option. This is one of the hardest things to do. It's a really good question. And I often think I should have a top hat that I put on, and I'll try and do Jacob's Rees-Mogg. So I'll try and do it sincerely. Jacob's father, William, his last book he wrote in collaboration with somebody else before he died was called Sovereign Wealth. And it was a blueprint for Brexit. And William Rees-Mogg, who was editor of the Times, said that the world future will depend on moving money around the planet. Whichever country manages to become the financial centre of the world the place with the lowest taxes for hedge funds, the most well-lubricated financial system, will win, because finance has risen up and up and up. Now, if we weren't to leave, the regulations that are coming in from Brussels will control our hedge funds, will control our financiers, and eventually we won't be able to have tax rates which are so low as we do have. So if we want to become the world treasure island, the centre of global banking, the place where the billionaires really want to be in the world, this is what we need to do. And that will create jobs. Billionaires need people. Okay, and they probably won't call them servants. We'll come up with a new name, but it'll create jobs for your children and grandchildren. And that's the kind of economy we could be in. We'll be great again, and our GDP per head will be the highest in the world. Now, even George Osborne, who was against the referendum in 2015, promised that if we followed his economic plan, by 2030, our GDP per head will be the highest of any large country in the world. So the benefits of Brexit, from the point of views of the people like Jacob and Aaron Banks arguing most for them, are to make this country the richest, most financially successful country, which will attract talent from outside. It means we can skim off money from all the money moving around, and means there will be something to do for the youngsters. And it'll be the heart and the beacon of freedom against terrible regulations and over-government control in other places. And we can bring in US healthcare, I don't know, go on and on. And, you know, only 7% of kids go to private school. Why can't we get it to 50? Our universities are currently only allowed to charge £9,250 a year to students. In America, they can charge £60,000 a year. You know, we could fully deregulate and live the dream. I don't know if I'm putting it well for him. And the other benefits, it's hard to think about what European regulations actually make things difficult for us. You know, we're still allowed to use miles and feet, we're still allowed to use our weird plugs.
It might reduce exploitation.
Okay, yes. Let's do the Lexit one. Sorry, the Lexit one. Currently, and it's been interesting, Lexit is the left-wing argument for Brexit, which was very strong in the referendum in 1974. And I would have probably voted not to join, by the way, because in 1974, 1975, we were the second most equitable country to Sweden. So we weren't actually doing that badly. We didn't join to actually join. We joined because we wanted to have access to that market to make money out of the rest of Europe, which wasn't a very good kind of a plan. The Lexit argument is that if we leave, we have complete control over our economy. We can nationalise large numbers of things, which is not allowed under European law. We can make the trains run well, and we can have British jobs for British workers. That was part of the Lexit argument. So I'm trying to be fair. Socialism in one country, and the revolution will begin in Britain. These are fantasies of various groups. Fantasies occasionally work out, but I don't think that socialism in one country, or the treasure island of the planet, is necessarily going to be the way forward. One interesting thing just to end on, is I've twice been invited to Guernsey to talk on this. Because Jersey, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, sadly nobody's asked me to go to the Cayman Islands yet. They're really, really worried. Because if we do leave with a hard Brexit, and then deregulate finance, there's absolutely no need to risk having your money on a small offshore island, because you can just do it in London. And that may be positive, not having quite so many. I personally don't think any of this is going to happen, and the reason I don't think it'll happen is the European countries after 2008 were really scared about financial instability, much more than we realise. They were very worried about what was happening in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal. They were worried about the euro and the stability of the euro, and how you have a euro when you have different government regimes in different countries. And the finance ministers of the EU27 are determined to make sure that the economics of the EU27 is safe. And having a treasure island offshore doesn't make it safe, and so we will be treated like Morocco.
and you will not be able to just move capital and money out of London to the mainland if we do leave suddenly. Not because they're being vindictive, but because they want to protect economic stability in the Eurozone. Who else had a question?
Supposing we do leave and we deport all migrant workers, how long do you think it would take to recruit and train enough homegrown workers to replace them all?
Okay, if we did that, we kind of did under Labour in 1965. We have a terrible history of migration, and we got to learn from it. We were very open up until about 1905, when we introduced the First Aliens Act. We allowed Karl Marx to come and live and write here. And then in 1905, because we really didn't like all those Jewish people coming in, and Eastern Europeans, we slammed on the brakes. And then we did it again. We did it to the Poles straight after the Second World War with the help of the unions. There were colour bars where black people weren't allowed to work in factories in this country that we don't talk about now. And then, British used to mean empire. Everybody in the empire had a British passport. They all had a right to be here. And we slammed on immigration controls in 1965. Some people managed to bring in their grandparents in time, others didn't. So we've done it before. 2003 was the third time we'd done this trick. To go back to the 1960s, Enoch Powell was the health secretary. Enoch went out to the Caribbean and begged people to come over to be nurses. He went to the Indian subcontinent and asked men to come and be bus drivers. And a few years later, he did his River of Blood speech. 2003, we invited them. This is what we actually did. We chose to invite early. So we got the really, really, to stereotype, really good plumbers. Right? We got the most get-up-and-go immigrants. The people who were a little bit more timid, who weren't quite so brave, they waited a few years and went to France and Germany and the Netherlands and Sweden and so on. Deportation. It's impossible to do. I live 6 miles from the largest detention centre in Britain, Campsfield House, which the government had plans to double in size and then abandon them. It's actually not possible to do it. You can make life very, very uncomfortable for people, and we are doing that at the moment largely through cock-up. There'll be people in this room who have gone through the app and the registration scheme and trying to find 4 or 5 documents for every year for the last 7 years or 10 years or whatever. But the Home Office has been incompetent for years. I've got a horrible feeling that when all the stories come out and people write their memoirs, it'll turn out that they really were trying to make a slick system to allow you to register to be here. And not. It's almost also certainly illegal for us to deport people who are here with a right to be here. Illegal under international law. So I just don't think we're going to manage it. And the other thing that's well worth saying is that for most of the last 200 years we've been an emigrant nation. More people have left than have come in. This happened in each of the last 3 big recessions. If you remember Alfie to St. Pet, the people going from Newcastle to Germany, happened in the 1990s, we were a net emigrant nation. ONS currently say that their migration statistics are now unreliable. They can't measure them. The 1991 census found 1 million fewer people here than we thought. 2001 census found 1 million fewer less than we thought. 2011, because we'd opened the doors and said come in, found 1 million more than we thought. We just don't have the infrastructure to do it. But it's a horrible thing we're doing. I grew up in a mixed family. 2 of my brothers were black in the 1970s. And I can remember the National Front saying go back where you come from then. And you probably all got a feeling about what that was like. I can remember the swastikas and I can remember the skinheads. You know, the really upsetting thing about this is that for an Eastern European child in a primary school in Britain now, it's absolutely as bad as it was for my brothers in the primary school in the 1970s. And it's shameful. And we have to tell people that is shameful. We invited people here. You know, that, and that message has to go out. We decided to do it. We didn't have to open up in 2003 and be the only large country to open up. And to do that, and then to tell people you don't want them anymore, within such a short amount of time, just makes you look really bad. One of the things that stunned me about Brexit has been how nice the other EU27 have been to us. It's like as a competition not to be the first country that says, oh, what on earth are you doing? You know, it's really interesting to watch the behaviour of other heads of states of other European countries, particularly the heads of state in Poland, particularly when there were Polish people who were murdered and stabbed to death over this. It's been dignified, and we haven't really noticed. There are beginnings of things which different. There's a big party to be held on the coast of the Netherlands on Halloween, which is a goodbye Britain party. And the logo for the party is, it's a bit like saying goodbye to a rather stupid friend who's going on a long journey. So we're beginning to get a little bit of it, but not much. But what I don't think is happening yet is people on the mainland don't yet realise why, what was different about this country, how this happened. And I think that'll take longer. We're fascinated about it, so we will work out what we're doing and about ourselves eventually. But we may have become so unimportant that people on the mainland may never know. I first realised this when at my college in Oxford there was a political reporter from Amsterdam coming over, and she was sitting next to me at this posh high table having lunch, and we were talking about Article 50, and she said, what is Article 50? And I suddenly realised, oh, this really, really, really doesn't matter to you, does it? Does it? And that's a bit of a shock when you realise that. Who has got the question, who has not? Can you come all the way up, sir? And then I'm desperately trying to think of something more interactive for our last 15 minutes. No, you're okay? All right. I get sick of listening to me.
This is the group back there. We're trying to combine two questions. The Remain grouping seems relatively weak in influence, and the ERG and its type seem remarkably strong in influence by their numbers. Can that balance be... why is that like that? And can anything be done to rectify the imbalance?
Yes, that's a really good question. You've got to remember that the Leave group have been going for a very, very long time. Jimmy Goldsmith galvanised them in 1997 with the referendum party. Anybody of my age or older would have received, was it a VHS video cassette about leaving? He spent a fortune, put up a candidate in every constituency, got about 2% of the vote. Then UKIP built up and up and up. This is a long time. The European Research Group, the group of Conservative MPs, this is a Conservative project, by the way. It's got nothing to do with the white working class in the north of England. It's people in Tory constituencies in the bulk in the south of England, and their MPs are leading this. Ever since they stabbed Major in the back, and you remember Major's fall, Major is not a man, you know, I don't think he's sworn since in public, to be honest. Yeah. This has really, really mattered to them. It's fundamental about sovereignty, destiny, power, not being ruled by others, getting our rightful place back, sorting everything out. It's a mixture of trickery, where when people find that they can't get a house, you tell them it's the immigrants. When they can't get the doctor's appointment, you tell them it's the immigrants. And when they're schooled, they don't think it's very good because you introduce league tables. You tell them, oh no, it's not the league tables, which of course made some schools appear good and other ones bad. You tell them, oh, it's the immigrants. So a mixture of trickery and true belief. The ERG truly, truly believe that things will be better if we leave. And they've had years of planning for this. Remain, there was nothing there. The chief executive of the campaign for Remain was Jack Straw's son, Will Straw. Will Straw, whose great claim to fame before was being picked up by the police, I think, for puking in Oxford in the street as a young man. I mean, you wouldn't, nice enough, you know, you wouldn't put Will Straw in charge of the destiny of the country versus Dominic Cummings. Leave actually spent marginally, well, the legal spending was slightly higher. Of course, Remain spent a lot of money illegally. Leave spent around £7 million on the Leave campaign. 4.8 million of that was spent by Jeremy Corbyn. People don't know this. Jeremy Corbyn sanctioned 4.8 million of the entire campaign spending for Remain. When he says 7 out of 10, the problem is Jeremy's kind of got a truth to Tourette's. He can't help saying what he actually thinks. And he actually means he was 7 out of 10 in favour. If he'd been 10 out of 10, he'd have spent 6.5 million. But you know, it was not a well-organised campaign. There was also complacency at the top. I just moved back to my city, my home city, in 2013, having lived for 30 years in the north of England. And I suddenly realised what elitism really meant when I got my job at Oxford. And what was fascinating, a very close friend of mine was the trustee of the BBC, became a close friend, he wasn't before I moved to Oxford, the trustee of the BBC who made the decision of absolutely equal representation during a campaign. So they only had two economists who were pro-leave. Those two economists appeared just as much in total airtime as all the others. And it was a sense of fairness. And the sense I got in Oxford was there is no way that Leave will win. So we need to be as fair to them as possible because they'll complain otherwise. The situation now, Leave is fractured. There are the hard leavers and the wanting to sort it out leavers. Remain may not be as fractured as it appears. Jeremy Corbyn is still 7 out of 10. There are people in his inner circle, and inner circle's tiny. They almost all went to public schools, by the way, which is ironic. You know, that's the kind of group of people around him. There are socialists in one country, people there, but if you go out to the next 12, they're in the minority and it's Remainers. All the young Labour candidates to be MPs are Remainers, the majority are Remainers. Labour is essentially a Remain party, the bulk of its membership are Remainers. And its majority of its voters are Remainers. But if you're trying to win this thing, it may, looking magnanimous as if you're not stitching it all up, Labour are certainly good at doing a good job of that, might in hindsight not be so much of a problem. But, you know, the majority in Parliament against a hard Brexit is huge. Absolutely huge. The amount of time they've had planning this summer to stop it is a lot of time. They haven't all been spending it all in Tuscany by a swimming pool. They have plans. This is a defining moment of their careers. They're talking to each other, working out what they can do, and they have the Speaker clearly on their side. And it's ironic that individuals might really matter. But having the Speaker on your side who controls what is actually allowed to happen and has the support of the majority of MPs, it's going to be very, very interesting. I will be, what's this horrible word? When Conservatives get really annoyed with people, they use this word. I will be disappointed. It's the worst insult you can get. Very polite, Mark. If our MPs who we've elected cannot halt or delay this, you know, it's a reflection of something even worse about our country than we already knew. Last kind of statistic about I'll give you, this shocked me, things like that. You'll often hear that Britain is the second largest arms trader in the world. The government actually say this statistic quite proudly, with the second biggest, what they call it, defence systems or something. And of course the campaign against the arms trade say it's terrible, Britain is the second biggest arms trader to the USA. A Swedish academic quietly pointed out the other day we're actually number 6. Right? There's another 4 countries in between us and the USA that sell more arms in terms of dollar value than we do. But the fact that both the pro and anti-arms industry want to say we're second, you know, it's really interesting. The number of things we rank highly at are not very many. Second number of medals in the Olympics, but we spent an awful amount of money for each of those medals, and also we helped organise the Olympics, so there's an awful lot of sports which involve sitting down on horses or shooting things and so on, or in boats. It's hard. There aren't many things now. We talk about our great universities, but we use ranking systems which were devised in the US or the UK or Singapore. When the OECD measure our graduates, this is embarrassing, for their ability at numeracy and literacy, we come out in the bottom half of the table in Europe for the ability of our university graduates. Those kind of things are embarrassing. But the one that you will be hit by the most will be when, officially, we are no longer the fifth largest economy in the world, but the sixth, seventh, and my prediction is 12th within about 2.5 years. And it's an easy prediction to make, because the statistics are always lagged by about 2 years, and it's all measured in dollars, and we already know how the pound has moved against the dollar. So unless the pound suddenly shoots up in value, we are rapidly heading down from 5th to 12th. And the tragedy then, the thing we have to look out for and worry about, is that we become more divided as we blame each other for this. And say, oh, it's people like me not being patriotic enough, not getting with the programme. If only people like me had really believed in Brexit, it could have worked. The really important thing from my point of view is that there's nothing wrong in being the 12th largest economy in the world, right? There is no need to be, given our population. We have less than 1% of the world's adults. We have much less than 0.5% of the world's children. We are going to need people coming in. There is no reason why we should be up there. We're going to have to go through a process of adjustment. Adjustment is very tricky. The last country which was the most powerful in the world before us was the United Provinces, which is now the Netherlands. And the Netherlands are now quite well sorted out. But it took being invaded by Germany to finally, and then the awful starvation, and our failing to get that last bridge, if you remember the movie and the reality. You know, the Netherlands adjustment to we are normal Europeans happened then, quite a long time ago. This country is going to have to go through the same. Huge transformations occur after wars. We were last at our peak inequality at the beginning of World War One. We had to tax the rich to pay for World War One. That was the beginning of the rise in inequality. When the men came back from fighting World War Two, they voted differently and changed everything. I quite like Brexit because it's much, much better than the war. But we, you know, if you want to tell the young that the older generation got it wrong, not to trust them, don't behave like them, do this to them, but also give them massive debts if they go to university, or sanction them if they don't, make them pay rent that you've never seen before. I paid £9 a week as a student. In Oxford it's £600 to £700 a month for a bed. Right? Do all of that if you really want to get a generation to change. Oh, and then burn the planet and say you don't care. And you may think I'm being over-optimistic about it, but last Easter we had 1,000 people arrested in London. This has not happened at any demonstration, as far as I'm aware, ever. Not at Greenham Common, never. 1968 was just a few dozen arrests. It was tiny in the LSE. 1,000 young people being willing to be arrested is incredible. What, I'm generally into being peaceful, what the authorities are really, really scared of is school children. You can't arrest a school child unless you have a responsible adult there. So what happens if 20 of them are there? Well, to give you a last anecdote on this, because we'll do one more question and I'll stop. One of our students phoned me up from the bridge in London and said she was about to get arrested. And would it affect her degree at all and so on? And I said, yes. I said, don't. Whatever you do, don't get arrested. Because she was American and she could have been deported. So for somebody like me to be telling people not to get arrested if you're properly English and you've only got one passport, get some advice. Extinction Rebellion, they've got a tent here, they're at every festival this summer. They have the best lawyers I've ever seen. The lawyers are there ready for you, and what's more, they're incredibly peaceful. It's the most peaceful demonstration group I've seen. And if you do happen to get arrested trying to save the planet, you will receive a very large number of anonymous love letters. So if you're ever sort of feeling in need of that. all these other things are happening as well as Brexit. Greta's on what day, 8 or 9?
Yeah.
All right, what a build-up. Yeah. How many people are there going to be on the dockside when she finally arrives on America? And you know, she's not got a date to come back yet. Right, she's got two continents travel over. It is quite incredible. In Belgium, 100,000 children have been on strike on Fridays. They're absolutely shocked by it. You can be very, in some ways, this is like the 1960s again. The Suez Crisis, what was it, 1956? Darkest hour, miserable time, end of austerity. We were going down in the world. Within 8 years, we had the swinging 60s, we had the Beatles complaining about paying a high rate of tax, which is silly. We were bringing in decent childcare allowances for the first time. We had Cathy come home, we were progressing things and making it better. We could very easily get another 1960s out of this. I'll give you, I'm gonna beat it, hold on, I'll give you one last personal statistic about Oxford and I'll end it on that. The highest year of increase in state school children ever at the University of Oxford was 1965. In 1965 we had an 8% jump at the university because the colleges agreed to end the corrupt practices where certain colleges like Winchester, certain schools like Winchester directly sent children to certain colleges, which is why we have a particular advisor around Jeremy Corbyn at the moment. 1965 was the biggest rise ever in state schools, and it's a change in the university. The second biggest rise was last year. Things are changing. This is the second biggest rise in a century. What happened last year, there's a general change of mood, but the University of Oxford lost a letter from the north, from the south London grime artist Stormzy. Stormzy has offered to fund two studentships. We never lose letters, but somehow we lost Stormzy's letter. And that got out, it was truly embarrassing, and the admissions officers changed their tune, but also large numbers of children from the 93% of schools that most people go to decided to apply. This interests me where I am, because my university reflects the society in general. When we were incredibly unequal in the 1920s, when the rich had servants, the most common job was to be a servant. It's a time that Sebastian and Bryce had revisited and all that kind of incredible snobbery. As the country became more and more equal in the 50s and 60s in particular, the town I grew up in became more mixed, and there was social mixing in the universities as well as in the city. As this country became more unequal in the late 70s, 80s, 90s and 2000s, my university became more unequal, and it produced a particular set of teenagers who graduated in 1984, 85, 86 and 87, who are especially vicious and really, really loved Margaret Thatcher as teenagers. And that's our current Prime Minister, our last Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister before, and the Chancellor of Exchequer and all of them. That time is over. Those people don't exist anymore. It's one generation that's gone through. The students who are arriving in my university in a few weeks' time will be the largest cohort ever from normal schools, and what I really hope for them, if you take the analogy of 1965, is that in the summer of their second year, it'll be like 1967, and if any of you can remember 1967, it was the summer of love. Yeah. And things can change very, very, very quickly. Right, we're doing our very best to show young people that they need to act and do things, and they cannot trust the wisdom of their peers, even though their grandparents care for them. Their grandparents are not necessarily in the right position to make the right judgments for them. Just as was the case two or three generations ago, when an older set of grandparents sent British people to war for the second time for a war which could have been avoided. Thank you for putting up with me for so long.